Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Another day, another milestone. For the first time, new coronavirus cases yesterday topped 75,000. Less than 3 weeks ago, the daily caseload was half that size.
And President Trump's response to the pandemic is not inspiring trust. A new Washington Post ABC News poll today shows 6 in 10 Americans do not approve of the way he's handled the outbreak. Beth Fooey is senior politics editor for NBC and MSNBC, and she's here with us now to take a look at the week in politics. Hi, Beth.
Hi, Peter.
Hey, so another week of bad polls for the president, another week of record numbers for coronavirus cases. Do you get the sense that President Trump himself feels that he's in trouble?
Well, you'd never know it to listen to his rhetoric, but you just have to look at the objective evidence. I mean, the two things that you just mentioned, polls going down, coronavirus cases going up, that's the metric, and that is going to be the metric by which President Trump is judged. So it's not surprising that those two are so correlated at this point. Look, President Trump is trying to change the subject every day. Just yesterday, he did an event about getting regulations off the backs of small businesses. A couple days earlier, he talked about building infrastructure. He's talking about everything but the thing that people want him to talk about, which is what the federal government is going to do to arrest this terrible, terrible pandemic that we're all living through. And until and unless he does so, he is going to continue to see his polls drop.
He demoted his campaign manager this week, so that may be one sign. What else is the campaign trying to do to turn the ship around besides changing the subject? What will work for him?
Well, he's been doing those events at the White House that are designed allegedly as White House presidential speeches, but are essentially campaign events. He takes off after Joe Biden in those events, two of which we saw this week, calling him a socialist and saying that Joe Biden would abolish the suburbs if he became president and other such things. The campaign is on the air and in our Facebook feeds across the country with a very, very aggressive advertising campaign. Again, calling Joe Biden a lot of different names, saying that he is senile, saying that he is going to be running the government the way socialists and the likes of AOC would want him to, that he's sort of a puppet. So they're certainly out there with their messaging. The problem is that the messaging isn't working for President Trump. None of those accusations are sticking to Vice President Biden. And as long as that virus is out there, people don't want to hear about that from President Trump. They want to hear him do his job and focus on the emergency.
We've got some tape from one of those events that you're referring to. Here he is in Atlanta this week talking about cutting red tape to build highways.
So we're cutting the federal permitting timeline for a major project from up to 20 years or more, hard to believe, down to 2 years or less.
And here is Joe Biden, who outlined his plan for climate change this week.
When Donald Trump thinks about climate change, the only word he can muster is hoax. When I think about climate change, the word I think of is jobs.
Beth, what are the big trends to watch for in the week ahead for Joe Biden?
Well, the big thing we're waiting for, obviously, is his choice of a running mate. And we know that that process continues apace. Joe Biden has said he's going to choose a woman. So we are all kind of watching the different women who we know to be on his short list and how they are conducting themselves, even as they are going through a very thorough vet. We have been told that the Biden campaign expects the vice president to name his number two probably around the week of August 1st, but it could be a little bit later. The Democratic convention starts on August 17th. So we know he needs to choose and announce someone before then. But what our reporting tells us is that he's sort of taking his time and is really doing a deep look at all of these different potential candidates before making his selection.
One more thing I want to ask you about. We're just hearing about today, this morning, a big shakeup in New York Democratic Party politics. Congressman Elliot Engel, longtime congressman, has now officially lost his primary to the progressive challenger Jamal Bowman. What do you make of that?
Well, I live in that district, so I've been following this very carefully. And yeah, it's a pretty big shock. And once again, showing that in many parts of the country, the progressive movement is on an ascent, certainly if you find the right kind of candidate. And in this case, Jamal Bowman sort of fit the moment. He's African-American. He grew up in a housing project. His sort of ascent really did come along with the protests that went along that we were seeing in 6 to 8 weeks ago around the death of George Floyd. He's a good candidate. He's very much of the district. And Elliot Engel, while the chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, had been around for a long, long time, and voters decided that they needed a change.
Beth Fooey, I got to leave it there, but thank you so much.
You bet.
Now to Asheville, North Carolina, where the city council this week apologized for slavery and approved reparations for Black residents there. The funding would go towards programs that increase career opportunities in home ownership for Black Americans. It does not include direct payments. And Asheville is just one of a number of local governments taking up reparations. Councilwoman Shanika Smith supported the measure, and she joins us now. And Councilwoman, can you explain how this will work, how much money the council is talking about, and where it will go?
All of that is to be determined. I think this is a major celebration, but the victory is forthcoming. We have a lot to think about and think through, but I think just to count this as a celebration would be to mark that the city is taking full accountability for unjust practices during the times of slavery, its segregation, what is perpetuated through our criminal justice system. And it also calls on a lot of bodies throughout our city, a lot of institutions, a lot of nonprofits, who we are asking to join in on this apology and also inviting them to address racism within their own structure. The resolution is also powerful in that it calls on the state of North Carolina and the federal government to initiate policy making and provide possible funding and provide what we're pushing for, some type of funding measures for reparations at the state and the national level.
You told the Asheville Citizen Times that you received emails from people asking, why should we pay for what happened during slavery? How have you responded to those questions?
I have gracefully decided not to respond because they're multiple. There are a lot of emails, and it just shows that there is a lack of education in our country as it pertains to the institution of slavery and a lot of the programs that followed slavery, like your sundown laws, Jim Crow laws, the peonage camps, and several things that we learned through sometimes in our families and community enrichment programs, but it is vastly missing in our public education system.
Mm. William Darity is a professor of public policy at Duke University, and he told the New York Times that he's skeptical about local and piecemeal actions. He's calling for this broader acknowledgement and broader reparations, basically in the amount of $10 to $12 trillion. And we know lawmakers in Congress have tried and failed for many years. We're talking 2 to 3 decades to get a bill on reparations through. Do you see local municipalities taking on this action as a way to pressure the federal government to take this action?
I do. I think it is the local government taking personal responsibility, but then leaning on the father of it all, which would be the federal government, to actually aid and assist and to hear the case of state government and the local repair needed. Asheville, North Carolina, has a very unique story as it pertains to slavery, but primarily in my heart, urban renewal. Urban renewal had a very devastating effect on Asheville, and historians have made a great case for reparations as it pertains to the decimation of home ownership, business districts, and future career opportunities that come from home ownership and having equity and having business opportunities. I think that's a very unique story here in Asheville. So us taking on this resolution and bringing on the what I'm calling the personal responsibility from the city of Asheville, I think it makes a better case when we step forward to call on the state and the federal government to take action.
This is such an enormous task to take on.
Yes, ma'am.
Have you all even began starting to think about the timeline and when you want to start to see results from this action?
Well, the resolution kind of gives us a sneak peek into a timeline. Within the next year, there is going to be what they're calling a community reparations commission established. But I think that the conversation is so rich and the conversation is so intense right now. I hear a lot of solutions. I hear even a skepticism. I think it's all going to be at work to kind of put something together to present and kind of kickstart a conversation here.
That's Asheville Councilwoman Shanika Smith. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Bard College at Simon's Rock, where students who crave intellectual freedom can begin college after the 10th or 11th grade. Bard College at Simon's Rock unleashes students' curiosity through a rigorous liberal arts and sciences curriculum and puts them on track toward completing a bachelor's degree 1 or 2 years early. Now accepting applications for fall 2020. simons-rock.edu/now, where independent minds get their start.
If you eat meat, you've almost certainly bought it from a Brazilian company called JBS, the number one supplier of beef and pork in the world. It's not exactly a household name, but in terms of sales here in the U.S., JBS is second only to Tyson. The company has also been at the heart of numerous COVID-19 outbreaks, both here in the United States and Brazil, and been accused of everything from selling rotten meat to bribing Brazilian officials. For more on the company and what their practices means for consumers, we have with us Dom Phillips, a freelance reporter for The Guardian in Brazil, and Esther Honig in Colorado, who covered JBS for FERN, the Food and Environment Reporting Network, in partnership with Mother Jones. Both join us via Skype. And I want to start with Esther. You've been reporting on JBS and the U.S. meatpacking industry for a few years now. Tell us what you've been hearing from JBS workers. You reported that hundreds have gotten sick and that at least 6 people have died. How is this happening?
So in previous reporting that I've done, workers have mentioned to me the bathrooms, that they're hardly ever clean. And so now during a time of pandemic, when the CDC is insisting that we wash our hands as often as possible, these workers are reporting that there was, in fact, no soap in the bathrooms for them to wash their hands. And not only that, but because of the nature of this work, you are sort of locked into your position along the production line. So this conveyor that's moving quickly through the plant and carrying large pieces of meat. And this is referred to as the chain. And that chain doesn't stop moving. And it's your job to pull these large pieces of meat off the chain and use an electric knife and a hook to break them down into smaller pieces that are then sold at, you know, grocery stores or restaurants. And so you actually have to find your supervisor, you have to flag them down, they come over, they give you permission to leave to go to the bathroom because they have to find someone else to replace you while you're gone. We also heard from workers who confronted their supervisors and told them they weren't feeling well. And supervisors told them there's no one to replace you. There's no one to come in and do your job if you leave. And that led to several instances that we heard of from workers in which they witnessed their coworkers fainting on the production line, potentially due to the effects of COVID-19, just from being so exhausted and not being able to leave work to take that time to recuperate.
In Colorado, Esther, you'll know this. Is it right that the company said at one point that it was going to test all the workers and then change its mind and decided not to?
Exactly. So this came as the outbreak was becoming even more and more severe at the plant. And the county health officials were actually arguing with county commissioners who were siding with the company. This all came out in records requests by local reporters here. And then when it finally, at a state level, the health department stepped in and said, you're going to close the plant and you're going to test all the workers. And at this point, JBS really couldn't hide anymore and say that they had things under control. And so they began testing workers, and they reports from the union as well as workers say that it started with the supervisors, the plant floor supervisors. And as more and more of these tests came back positive, the company reneged that offer to test their entire workforce because it just would have been sort of a PR nightmare. And so it had gone all the way up to the White House, where Mike Pence had come in and said, we're going to help JBS test all of these workers. We're going to get this under control. They, in fact, did not. And even as the governor of Colorado insisted that they test workers, they didn't. What it came down to was the state of Colorado offering a testing site just about a mile away from the plant so that workers could go there and get tested. So JBS at this time came forward saying, we're going to donate thousands of dollars to the food bank, to United Way, and we're also going to gift thousands of test kits to the community. So they were offering to gift tests to community members while they were at the same time denying testing their own workers.
And some JBS and Tyson workers have now filed a discrimination lawsuit against their employers, claiming that actually 90% of the meatpackers who got sick with COVID have been people of color. I'm wondering, what has JBS said about all of this?
So they have said that they've now implemented measures that encourage workers to stay home while they're sick. Whether they're being paid for that time or not is unclear. JBS has said that they have given workers above the age of 60 and who are considered at risk, so folks with certain pre-existing conditions, they've given them leave with pay and full benefits. So JBS's response is that they have, in fact, implemented measures to try and counter this pressure that workers were feeling to come in and work while sick. That being said, we continue to see outbreaks at plants, and we continue to see the number of worker deaths continue.
I want to bring in Dom Phillips in Brazil. This is certainly not JBS's first major issue. You have been covering their activity there in Brazil for years. What is the reputation there?
Well, JBS is a huge and very powerful company, and the biggest company in a huge and very powerful sector. The meat sector employs 500,000 people in Brazil, and it's very important in the agribusiness sector. So, you know, it's a very powerful company here. It has a complex reputation in Brazil because it's been involved in a series of scandals. Going back to 2009, when JBS and other meat giants signed a deal with Greenpeace and also with prosecutors, two separate deals to try and control cattle coming from deforested areas. And in those deals, the company promised within 2 years to control what are called their indirect suppliers. And this is the big problem that the company is facing at the moment. The way this works is that cattle are raised on a sequence of farms before they reach the slaughterhouse. There might be what's called skinny cattle on an initial farm, and then they're taken to a second farm and they're fattened, and then they might go on to the slaughterhouse. JBS and the other companies say that they are sure that all their direct suppliers do not come from any farm that has any problems or any fines or any embargoes for deforestation, but it can't control whether those cattle have come from another farm before they reach the farm that doesn't have any problems. It says that this is an industry-wide problem, and that it's trying to work with the government and other stakeholders to try and resolve it. It will not answer questions on how much of its cattle has come from the indirect suppliers, and at one point was even denying that it got any cattle from indirect suppliers. One of its rivals, which is a big Brazilian international company called Mafrig, have said it's around about half of their cattle from the Amazon, just to give you an idea.
Esther, BuzzFeed recently ran a story on the 4th of July called Who Died for Your Dinner, acknowledging the workers who have died from COVID-19 to bring us our hamburgers and hot dogs. And I'm just wondering, as you both cover this industry, but I'll start with you, Esther, have your own eating habits changed?
I think that's a great question. And, you know, I think I'm guilty of professing that I want to do more, that I want to, you know, research where I can find a small local producer who I think is raising cattle in a way that's ethical and maybe supporting a small packing house, you know, because there are smaller packing houses, though there aren't nearly as many as there used to be. And that's just because of these burdensome regulations. But more than likely, you know, this meat in our food system that comes from these corporations like JBS, like Smithfield and Cargill, it's so pervasive. I mean, it's everywhere. And we don't see these names. You know, these are some of the biggest corporations that many of us have never heard of, because when Right. you go to the grocery store, you don't see the JBS logo sticking out in the, you know, mound of ground beef behind the counter.
Right, exactly. February of this year, the U.S. actually began giving or clearing the way for those Brazilian beef imports to start up again. There's no way to tell as a consumer if your meat actually comes from JBS. I'm wondering from you, Dom, your thoughts on this and what's important for consumers to know as they think about their relationships with the companies that supply their foods.
I think it's important to know that not all farms are involved in deforestation. In fact, there's a study that we've written about in The Guardian from Science magazine that found that in terms of soy, there were 2% of properties involved in 62% of illegal deforestation. So it's not all of them. The second thing is, I think we need to be really clear, the Brazilian government's coming under a lot of pressure from international companies, international investors, and Brazilian companies, putting pressure on Brazil over the negative image that its failure to protect or its unwillingness to protect the Amazon is causing for the company, for the country, and for investors. Brazil is trying to fight back by saying that it really protects the Amazon, that it's very concerned, that environmental protection is very important to this government. This is simply not true. Brazilian government has no intention of protecting the Amazon. It just wants to convince consumers that it's doing so, but it's not. I think that's very important for any listener who is concerned about the environment or concerned about what they're eating to be really aware of that. It's not.
That was Dom Phillips and Esther Honig, freelance reporters who have covered JBS for outlets like Mother Jones and The Guardian. And shortly after we spoke, a Brazilian judge ordered all employees at a pork plant owned by JBS to stay home for at least 14 days due to the most recent coronavirus outbreak among workers. We also reached out to JBS for comment on these allegations, and the company responded saying it's invested more than $100 million to enhance safety measures because of the pandemic. JBS also said it has processes in place to ensure that its products don't contribute to deforestation in the Amazon. You can read the full statement at hereandnow.org.
You'd be forgiven for not understanding what's going on with the mask orders in Georgia. It's been a head-spinning couple of days. First, Governor Brian Kemp said cities and towns couldn't force their use in public. Yesterday, he sued the city of Atlanta. And then today, he said this.
Wear a mask when out in public or when you cannot distance yourself inside.
Emma Hurt is a reporter with WABE in Atlanta. Hi, Emma.
Hi.
So today the governor went on to say that people should wear a mask for the next 4 weeks. This is confusing to some people. Can you help us figure out where the governor stands on this issue?
Right. It is confusing. But I think, you know, Governor Kemp has actually been well into a campaign, really, to get people to wear masks. He's been on social media about it, encouraging people to wear masks. He's explicitly asked county and city officials to urge their citizens to wear masks. But the operative words here are urge and encourage. The governor still doesn't believe that mandating masks are the answer. He says that government is not going to be the solution and Georgians don't need a mandate to do the right thing. But a lot of people take issue with that when they see photos of Georgians crowded together and not wearing masks.
Yeah, and Kemp is arguing what a lot of people around the country have been arguing, essentially that this is an issue of personal freedom and of personal liberties. But at this point in the pandemic, Emma, would Kemp actually pay a political price if he just says, look, this is bad, you got to wear one?
You know, he might, because there are definitely Georgians and Americans who are not interested in wearing masks right now. You don't have to look much further than Facebook to find groups where people are really strongly arguing that. And Kemp alluded to them this morning. He said, for those people who don't want to wear masks, who, quote, fundamentally don't agree with that, don't want to do it for whatever reason, he said, if you're going to do that, then stay away from people. But I think the political dimensions here are really kind of confusing and interesting. Kemp has always been a governor in favor of local control. I covered his campaign. It was a central tenet then and has been of his administration. But while he's not wanting to bring the government into what you could call, you know, a local decision about putting on a mask yourself, he also is not wanting local governments to make their own regulatory decisions, which is, of course, what this lawsuit is all about.
Oh, wow. That's so interesting. Yes, he's suing Atlanta's mayor, Keisha Lance Bottoms, over her mask mandate. Sounds like that lawsuit is still ongoing. He hasn't changed his mind, in other words.
No. He doubled down on that this morning. And he said that the suit is on behalf of business owners, their employees, and hardworking Georgians. And I think it's important to understand that what he's referencing in particular is Mayor Bottoms' decision to recommend that Atlanta businesses move back to phase one reopening. Mm. That really seems to be the straw that broke the camel's back with this, on top of the mask mandates that have been released around the state. He said he's worried about the confusion this creates and the economic risk. The mayor, for her part, is standing by this, as if a lawsuit is what it's going to take to protect citizens, we'll see them in court.
And just very briefly, remind us how bad the pandemic is in Georgia right now.
Yeah, it's not great, just like it isn't across the country. The state's hospitalizations are at the highest point they've been since the beginning of the pandemic, up 40% really in the last week. And testing is our big problem. There's just been so much more demand. Capacity hasn't been able to keep up. Health officials say they're actually going to bring on a new commercial lab partner to address this, because right now some labs are taking up to 2 weeks or more to process, and that's basically useless public health data, as we know.
That's Emma Hurt, reporter with WABE in Atlanta. Emma, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Peter.
We got some sad news overnight. The legendary foreign correspondent Christopher Dickey died in Paris yesterday. During his long career, he reported from war zones and wrote books about the conflicts he covered. He also wrote novels. Chris Dickey was a great friend of this show. I remember speaking with him 5 years ago about a book he'd just written. It was called Our Man in Charleston, Britain's Secret Agent in the Civil War South. It was also just about a month after a white supremacist murdered 9 black people inside the Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, South Carolina. And just after the state's legislature had voted to take down the Confederate flag that had flown at the state house for decades. Chris Dickey's insights were so timely, it feels like we could have had the same conversation with him today. So here it is. In July 2015, I asked Chris about the subject of his book, a British consul named Robert Bunch, who was posted to Charleston in 1853.
He went there because he thought it might be kind of a good career move for a young and up-and-coming diplomat. But once he got there and saw the conditions of slavery, he became passionately opposed to the institution. But he didn't tell anybody, because he had to make nice with all those people, all those slave owners, all the elite of Charleston. And he did better than that. He ingratiated himself with all of them. All the while, over 10 years, he was writing secret dispatches and private letters back to the Foreign Office in London and to the ambassadors, the British ambassadors in Washington, D.C., and he was telling them exactly how horrible it was, and telling them also that the South was going to secede eventually, that it would expect Britain to support it, and that should not and could not ever happen.
So Robert Bunch was essentially a secret agent, and he was reporting what he found back to Britain. How did that influence the way Britain saw the war?
Well, theoretically, Britain was very much against slavery, but it had learned to live with Southern slavery, which raised 80% of the cotton in British mills. Where it drew a red line was about the question of the slave trade with Africa, which had been banned since 1807 by Britain and also by the United States. Slaves had gotten so incredibly valuable in the South by the 1850s that there was a huge push to reopen the slave trade with Africa. And if the South had done that, and there were many people saying that the South would do that, then that would have wrecked everything, all prospects for recognition by Britain. Eventually, Bunch convinced London that no matter what the Southerners said, they were going to do that as soon as they got the chance. And that is one of the things that stopped the British from giving the South the absolutely vital recognition it needed.
And we kind of forget that Britain had a complicated role in the Civil War and that it had a lot of interest, as you say, in the South.
Well, it did. And there were a lot of reasons that the Southerners had believed that, of course, London would back them. London got all its cotton or so much of its cotton from them. And they deluded themselves into thinking that it was a sure bet, that it would be game over as soon as they seceded. But that didn't happen, and Robert Bunch is one of the reasons why.
Let's bring this back to the modern day and the conversation that we've been having about the history of the war. And you've talked about the false histories that we tell ourselves about the Civil War. What do you mean by that, and how does this book address that?
Well, look, Peter, the big false history, and you still hear it argued all the time in the South, is that the Civil War was not, between quotes, about slavery. Oh, hell yeah, it was about slavery. Here's exactly how it happened, and you can tweet it out. The South seceded to protect the institution of slavery, and the North went to war to stop secession. That is how the war started. Eventually, by 1863, it became a crusade against slavery. But it wasn't in the beginning. But had there been no issue of slavery, there would have been no war.
Mm. So what do you make of the controversy that we've been having over the Confederate battle flag after the shootings in Charleston, South Carolina? You're a son of the South. What do you make of all this?
Well, I think people totally misunderstood and misunderstand what that battle flag has come to represent. When Robert E. Lee, whose battle flag it was, surrendered at Appomattox, that battle flag was furled and the war was over for him. That flag came out again with a vengeance as a reaction to the civil rights movement, starting in the 40s and building through the 50s and 60s. That was the flag not to honor the Civil War dead. That was a flag to say no to civil rights. It was held up in defiance by white people, for white people, in memory of people who didn't die, for the most part, defending slavery. They were sucked into the war by the elite slave owners. But once the war was started, they were dying to defend their homes and families, they thought. That's what they were dying for. But the flag, that's all about racism.
Chris, I want to ask you then, is there a way that we can appropriately honor the memory of the Confederate war dead if the battle over the Confederate flag is seemingly lost in South Carolina?
Well, I think, first of all, we do have to understand that hundreds of thousands of men and women died in the South in that war because they were led into it by an elite that was protecting its own very narrow interests, using its money, its power over the press, its power over the courts, its power of propaganda generally to do that. And then I think we have to say, were those people complete fools? No, they were deluded like people who were led into war all the time, many wars, even wars that have been fought in the last few years. So I think we just have to say, look, they fought bravely. They died bravely in many cases. They died for the wrong cause. But we shouldn't insult their memories just because some racists in the 1950s and 60s wanted to wave one of their flags.
So in that case, would you say that some sort of monument would be appropriate?
I think many of the monuments are. I think you have to look at them individually. Some of them are not. Some of them are erected to generals, for instance, who were really reprehensible people. But in fact, I think most of those small town monuments to the Confederate dead throughout the South should stand where they are. Mm-hmm.
This is all very personal to you, this history. Your uncle Tom used to hunt for Civil War shells and cannonballs, and you made a film about him. And at the end of this film, we see him defusing an old shell, which, by the way, is very dangerous work, some 150 years after the war. And he lights the powder, actually. Let's listen to some of that.
I do worry about it some, because if this house caught on fire, It could do a lot of damage around the neighborhood. You'd see you'd you'd hear the last shots fired during the Civil War.
That is quite an image. But you're still hearing the last shots of the Civil War. I guess, in a way, it seems appropriate, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, because we're still hearing in different ways the last shots fired in the Civil War. In one horrible way, we heard those shots fired in Charleston a few weeks ago. No, I think that my Uncle Tom was a charming guy, but his view of the war was all about armaments and munitions and being a collector. The real view that we have to have of the war is that it was fought for the interests of a very small group of people protecting their right to own slaves. And a lot of people who otherwise would not have been killed had to fight and die in that conflict.
You know, 150 years after the war, though, it seems like a very long time. I mean, what do you think? Will it take another 150 for those shots to be silenced? Or what does it take in the South for the legacy of the Civil War to – will it ever go away?
Well, I think the reaction to the murders in Charleston certainly is – a turning point in the way people think and talk about these issues. It can't be addressed casually anymore. It's not a half joke anymore. It's not an old man with a gray beard and a Confederate cap waving the flag saying, forget hell. No, it's not that anymore. I think we've had to look at it very seriously. And at the same time, I think we have to recognize that the South is changing really dramatically and that the scars left by the war, some of the scars left by slavery, and some of the scars left by the occupation by the North of the South after the war, those are fading now as the South picks itself up and moves on.
Christopher Dickey speaking with me in July 2015. He died yesterday in Paris, where he worked as a foreign editor for the Daily Beast. And Chris was on the show many times over the years. In 2013, Robin Young spoke with him about his father, James Dickey, the poet and author of Deliverance. It was a troubled relationship.
My father and I were reconciled in the last two or three years of his life, and I remember after he died going down to take care of all kinds of details, and he always had stacks and stacks of books around him, and the stacks of books that he had around him in his bed were all books about things that, you know, I was writing about. So,
were you seeing that he maybe cared more about you than you thought?
I was seeing that he was trying hard to understand what I did. So I tried hard to understand what he did. I think we pretty much came to do that by the end of his life.
Christopher Dickey was 68.
NBC dropped a reunion special of the sitcom 30 Rock on its streaming service Peacock today, and it's as much of a commercial as it is a comedy. Let's listen.
Kenneth is presenting all of NBC Universal's new content to advertisers tomorrow. The stakes have literally never been higher. He's got to sell a full year of ads in one meeting.
Thank God it's him. And thank God advertisers are some of the smartest and most physically attractive people this industry has ever seen.
This special was supposed to broadcast on TV stations last night, but many of them boycotted it. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us to explain. And Eric, why was there a boycott? Why did so many stations refuse to air this 30 Rock special?
Well, you know, it's interesting, and it's sort of wrapped up in how broadcast television works. Mm-hmm. You know, under the very traditional, old-school way of broadcasting television, a network like NBC creates programming, and then it sends it out to a network of individual local TV stations across the country that then broadcast it to their communities. So, you know, some of these companies decided that they did not want to air the 30 Rock special that was being sent to them by NBC because it's essentially a promotional vehicle to tell people about this new Peacock streaming service that NBC has created. The thing that's different about Peacock is that there's a tier of the service that's free because you can just agree to watch commercials. Well, the local affiliates are saying, that's what we do. You know,
right,
we
right.
present NBC programming with ads for free to people. And so I think there's a little bit of an internal friction there between the companies that own the affiliates and NBC, which is establishing this sort of direct connection with viewers that they previously weren't as aggressive about pursuing.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, do stations have any leverage to influence networks? I used to work in local television, and so I understand
how much emphasis is put on that affiliation? It seems like networks are only going to be more invested in streaming.
Yeah, because, you know, we're reaching a point, and I'm sure you saw it when you were in the business, you know, every year, traditional TV viewing is going down further and further. People are not necessarily turning to a local affiliate to see that NBC programming. They may be going to NBC.com. They may be going to YouTube. They may be going to Peacock. Now, I think the local affiliate is still very important, and that's why this friction is worth keeping an eye on, because, you know, affiliates for other networks are facing similar pressures. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're a CBS affiliate and there's this thing called CBS All Access that's a streamer that has a lot of CBS content on it, and people can subscribe to that instead of watching your station, you know, there's a natural tension there. So that tendency of people to stop watching broadcast and go to streaming services is even accelerated even more because of the pandemic. And so all these things are kind of coming together, and it's making for an issue that the TV industry has to deal with. And I'm not quite sure how it's going to turn out.
Eric, I want to talk to you about some other news as well. We've seen a wave of petitions and resignations over so-called cancel culture. There was a letter signed by author J.K. Rowling, among many others, for example, that condemned it. But that criticism sometimes overlooks the reasons people are calling for change in the first place. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, I'm very skeptical of people who criticize the excesses of what they call cancel culture, because I think a lot of what people name as sort of examples of this, it's really examples where media outlets have been asked for a long period of time to change their behavior, and they don't. And then it gets to the point where the audience or the staff at the organization draw a line in the sand and say they won't take it anymore. People have, for example, looked at the way James Bennett, who used to be the op-ed editor at the New York Times, you know, how he was forced to resign his job. Well, people had complained about the way he was giving certain conservative voices more latitude to say things that might be at odds with journalistic tradition at the New York Times. And then when he published an op-ed that had untrue elements in it that he hadn't even read, you know, he didn't have a leg to stand on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Tucker Carlson on Fox News saw his lead writer have to resign because the guy was anonymously posting racist comments online. I mean, you know, there is no world in which that is defensible for someone who works at a cable news channel. Mm-hmm. I would hope that it would be a lesson to media outlets to pay attention to their critics, and that when people raise an issue, don't let the scandal get to the point where someone has to lose a job. You know, be more transparent about what you're doing. Correct actions when you can before the controversy, you know, comes to a head. And of course, I hate bullying online. I hate bullying on social media. And I don't like the idea of a mob mentality going after everything that they might view as some sort of violation of an orthodoxy or way of thinking. But I think in a lot of these situations, it's a situation where the institution has been asked to change and it has ignored those calls for change. And then it gets to the point where people who oppose them have to ratchet up what they're asking for just to get the institution to pay attention.
That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, as always, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.